Aloha. This is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Tuesday, February 25th. Those agricultural declaration forms finally taken a step forward into the digital age. The global settlement over the Maui wildfire was a major turning point, but now a $1 billion fund being considered at the state legislature to cover Hawaiian Electric's future wildlife liability is getting closer scrutiny. And AI and art, we learn about a series of workshops focusing on indigenous futures. Plus, this weekend marked the 80th anniversary of the liberation of Manila from the Japanese. We take you to the Manila American Cemetery, where a ceremony was held acknowledging the sacrifices of those Filipinos and Americans who died in battle. We revisit a film that documents the sacrifices that were made and hear from a local Filipino veteran of the war. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. A plan years in the making to modernize agriculture declaration forms is finally taking off. Officials gathered at the Daniel K. Inouye International Airport yesterday afternoon to launch Akamai Arrivals, a pilot program that rolls out digital declaration forms to travelers. Governor Josh Green spoke at the unveiling of the digital program.
It's important that we come together to make good solutions. These creatures, which are very scary, especially this one, should not be coming into Hawaii. And it is excellent when they are captured because we have a unique, fragile, really irreplaceable ecosystem, and protecting it against invasive species is critical. So the ideas that you're going to see today are meant to help us make sure that we protect our ecosystem. Much credit due to the legislature and all to the Lieutenant Governor. This is something that has been plaguing us for a long time. I came back on a flight yesterday, received the obligatory form, and waited until the personnel on the plane said the usual. The state of Hawaii makes you fill out this form, but they do not give us pencils, so it's on you. And everyone looks around, they see me sitting there saying, where's my pencil? Why do I have to fill out this form? Okay? Those days are going to end soon. So it is a great relief to see this innovation. To have it be done electronically is going to be very positive. It's going to be helpful for our state. But most importantly, it's our biosecurity weapon. So it's not just about safeguarding for biosecurity agriculture. It's about protecting the global ecosystems.
The Conversation's Maddie Bender spoke with Jonathan Ho, branch manager for the Department of Agriculture, about his hopes for the program.
I guess it's been a long time coming. And COVID, I think, really kind of paved the way to getting to where we are with the Safe Travels form, in that it kind of showed everyone that digitizing something can enable compliance and all that stuff. So, you know, I think from the department standpoint, a lot of it was, what are the resources that are necessary to do it? So there was a little bit of apprehension in the beginning. And then last year, I believe it was Senator Wakai introduced a measure that made it very clear that a digital form could be used. Once that came into effect, the Lieutenant Governor's office with the department got all the airlines together, and you know, we plowed our way into where we are at now. And that's kind of how it kind of fell into place. But it's a good thing.
And so on the one hand, you have the ability to digitize. But then if you think about the flip side of it, the paper system that exists today, right now, what are some of the ways in which that system is outdated and suboptimal?
The paper form, I think it was implemented in like the 40s or something like that. So it's been around pretty much as long as the state has been. That's actually before the state has been a state. And, you know, it was designed for a very captive audience that wasn't at the volumes and the speeds of travel like it is now. Like, you know, back in the 40s, I don't think anybody was expecting that, you know, there would be millions of people flying into the state. So, over time, the form in of itself has become, you know, I guess, cumbersome. For example, you need to print and store paper. So obviously our office has these papers. There's a contract. They deliver them monthly. the airlines come to us in Honolulu monthly and distribute it throughout the state for use. You know, they often distribute the forms on the plane, they collect the forms on the plane, give them to us for processing, and then we transfer the forms over to the vendor who does the tourism portion. You know, so there's a lot of hands and movement, not just, I think, what the user experiences, which is filling out the form. And then you have the form itself, like, I don't have a pen and all those types of things, right? So if you can streamline it and get rid of all of those processes and do a lot of it automated, you know, whether it be emails or voice announcements using your own device, you can eliminate a lot of that. And I think that's kind of where we're at now, to the extent that it, you know, it'll kind of speed things up. And, you know, there's a lot of advantages. Presumably we'll be able to see things well ahead of time. We'll kind of know about how many people are going to be declaring or not. You know, we don't have unlimited staff, so the staff can look, oh, nobody declared anything. We have, you know, 78% declaration rate. Okay, we're going to prioritize this other flight, which has lower declaration rate with more things. You know, now the staff are kind of chasing. The forms come, you don't know what you get. Whereas in this one, you have this ability to now, like, plan with hours out for what duties that particular person is going to do. So, you know, there's some advantages.
So that seems to be one of the hopes with the digital pilot program. What are the other metrics or data points that you'll be looking at to deem whether the pilot is successful or not?
What we're really, really focusing on is managing the amount of declarations that we're getting against what was historically done. So the paper form, it's about 60% or so. That's about what we're getting. So this one, we're going to be able to see, like, obviously, is it more efficient to that extent? But we're working with airlines, and each of the airlines is distributing the forms to the clients slightly differently. I know one of them is definitely going to be using, they're not doing in-flight. So they're going to be doing it at the departure gate. They're going to be doing a lot of announcements. They're going to have staff with tablet, you know, to kind of facilitate, you know, the form. Most of the other airlines are going to be doing some form of periodic email announcements that are tied to the Akamai arrivals. They're going to be doing in-gate or gate waiting area announcements. They're going to be doing in-flight. Actually, I think all the other airlines, except for one, is going to be doing in-flight Wi-Fi, so you can do it on the plane. And, you know, the number of emails that they use, the number of announcements, you know, when they're doing all of that stuff is a little bit different. And I think one of the things we'll be able to do is, because they're all doing it slightly differently, you'll be able to kind of see which touch is the most effective, right? So, and in my estimation, it's going to be, while people are waiting to get onto the plane, is probably going to be, you have nothing better to do. So, like, you know what, fill out the form, you don't have to do it on the plane. So I have a feeling that's probably going to be the biggest touch. The data will probably show that. And then obviously we can incentivize it. And then you'll kind of know where everything is. And then knowing that if one airline is doing it, and or some are doing it, some aren't, hey guys, these are the touches that are more important. This is the messaging you need to do, all that kind of stuff.
But do you expect to see a decrease in the number or percentage of flights that fill out the form? Because just thinking about the system, it seems like one potential issue compared to a paper form is you come down the aisles, you can see exactly who has filled it out and who hasn't. And if it's online, do people really think it's mandatory?
What you're talking about is compliance. So right now, it's really focused on kind of the airlines doing it. And then obviously, when we take it, we're reviewing it. To the extent, I think, for whether or not I think people are going to be truthful with regards of filling it out. And the way that I kind of look at this, and again, not apples to apples, is like the speed limit. The speed limit is the law, right? Does everybody follow the speed limit, right? I mean, and not apples to apples, but the ability to compel is very targeted with regards to the county police officers, right? They have police powers, they can detain you, and you have a driver's license, which tells you you need to know what to do before you drive. Whereas the ag form, it's similar in that you have this very broad swath of people that are regulated, But you have a regulatory structure, you know, for example, I cannot detain people. I can't arrest people. And you have probably 50% of the people that are on the form that are covered who have never had to deal with the foreign potentials. It's their first time to Hawaii. They have no clue what to do. So like there's this expectation. Do I do it? Do I not? Is there going to be this compliance structure? And the form, the way that the department has really looked at it historically, is as a very good educational tool. People read the form, they see it on the plane, they're like, huh, wait, there's one, there's possibly a criminal penalty, but hey, if I declare I can, you know, do my part to not bring in an invasive species and a pest. And, you know, I think a lot of people criticize the form because, you know, they say it's ineffective, nobody does it. Probably about 75%, 75 to 80% of flights, people declare something. Apples, oranges, you know, I think what you would consider more common things. They're not prohibited in any way, but they could have pests. Probably 1 to 2 times a day statewide, you will get things that are regulated beyond just inspections. So things like radishes, pineapple, corn. And then maybe once or twice a year, you will get, I think, the more like high profile type animals. So one of the animals that they had yesterday at the display, there was a bearded dragon, and that bearded dragon was declared by somebody, and we were able to confiscate it before the person left. So, you know, so the form works, right? It's to what level is it effective, right? And again, I think you can go by the speed limit. How effective is the speed limit in guaranteeing people are driving at the speed limit? Questionable, but people aren't dying all the time and crashing all the time. So, right, I mean, it's clearly doing something. And I think the same thing to the extent of the ag form. It does that same thing.
So the pilot program runs from March 1st to May 31st on select flights, all major domestic airline carriers. What happens after May 31st?
Yeah, so we're going to be meeting with the airlines probably every 2 weeks to kind of, you know, just see how it's going. Provided it doesn't crash and burn, which I don't believe it will, but, you know, you have to be realistic. I mean, that's a possibility. Depending on, I think, what concerns or issues come up from the staff standpoint, from the data management standpoint, from the passenger standpoint, I think we're going to assess, you know, I think with the airlines, like, how effective is it? Can you guys roll it out to all your flights? How much time does it going to take? All that kind of stuff. Because if it is effective, I don't see why you wouldn't continue to expand upon it. I believe Southwest and I think American are already doing all their flights already. And I think for the user, you know, I think most people are very familiar with doing things online with phones and, you know, all that stuff. And then are there optimizations that we can make? Maybe you make an app for, you know, frequent flyers so that they don't have to type it in every time. They can just open up the app, put in their flight, submit, and then they're done. And a lot of that will kind of come out of the program. We'll kind of see what kind of feedback there is. Some people might prefer an app as opposed to doing a web form, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I think, you know, when we built the program, a lot of it was using, you know, existing contracts and funds. So we didn't put like millions and millions of dollars into this. And a lot of it was done in-house. So I think should it be deemed effective, obviously getting, you know, into these bigger contracts, you know, getting a lot of these, you know, people's whose primary purpose or job is to do a lot of this stuff to kind of get a lot of those individual components kind of really solidified for, you know, statewide rollout.
That was Jonathan Ho, manager for the plant quarantine branch at the Hawaii Department of Agriculture. The Akamai Arrivals pilot program begins on select domestic flights on March 1st.
After fleeing civil war in Syria, two musicians took up residence in Germany, where they teamed up with a local guitar player to make a new kind of sound.
A bit of classical, orchestra, or flamenco, and each one has a different background with the music and the instrument.
Transnational music, next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1. Support for HPR comes from Malamaola Health Services on Oahu, founded by physicians, dedicated to providing hospice and palliative care to patients and their families. Learn more about services at malamaolacares.com.
Honolulu Civil Beat is tracking a bill that stands to affect just about everyone in Hawaii. It has to do with wildfires and Hawaiian Electric's plan to cover its future liability by charging its customers a fee. Joining us this morning is business reporter Stuart Yurton. Good morning, Stuart.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so this is one of those pocketbook issues.
It is a pocketbook issue, and as you said, Hawaiian Electric wants to help deal with future wildfires and liability concerning those by raising a big pot of money, $1 billion. It also wants limitations on liability in future wildfires.
And it's been on shaky ground since the Lahaina wildfires.
It has been. So a similar bill died last session a year ago. This new bill is making its way through the legislature, their companions, so House and Senate versions. And they're getting a lot of pushback from lawmakers.
Yeah, I know your story has gotten lots of hits from your readers weighing in.
Yes, readers don't like it, and lawmakers don't like it 100%. And the idea is residential customers would pay about $4 a month extra. It would be a fee. It would go to pay back this $1 billion loan. Lawmakers are saying, wait a minute, it shouldn't be $1 billion for customers and only $5 million for Hawaiian Electric. Hawaiian Electric should contribute more. There was one proposal that Hawaiian Electric would have to pay half. That got taken out, but it still seems to be the case that the legislature wants Hawaiian Electric to pay at least some or a lot more than $5 million. There's also questions about this limitation on liability. That's been taken out, and lawmakers have tacked on some other things that Hawaiian Electric doesn't want. So it's kind of looking bad for Hawaiian Electric, the way this bill is going now.
And so tell us about who else has been weighing in on this.
Well, we have customers weighing in. The governor weighed in and said, yes, Hawaiian Electric should pay something. We have the Carpenters Union saying, wait a minute, this puts a burden on customers. We already pay the highest electric rates in the country by far, and this is an even bigger burden on us and cost of living in Hawaii. The Public Utilities Commission came in, and they're the ones that pointed out, hey, wait a minute, a similar fund in California is split 50-50 between the utility and the customers. Now, Hawaiian Electric has said, the situation here in Hawaii is different than in California, and we just don't have the money to put up half.
Yeah, but at the same time, you want this to be a fair deal.
You want it to be a fair deal, and as you pointed out, a lot of our readers have been weighing in saying, this isn't a fair deal, and lawmakers also pushing back. The one thing to bear in mind, and this is key, is that Hawaiian Electric's credit rating is really low. That means it costs it more to borrow money, and that extra interest that it has to pay to borrow money also gets passed on to customers. So customers are going to pay no matter what. And Hawaiian Electric has data showing that this is better. The $4 a month is better than what customers would pay if everything else is just left alone. So I think really the question is going to come down to how much Hawaiian Electric is going to be willing to put into this, because lawmakers right now don't seem to be willing to say customers have to foot the whole bill. But it does seem to be clear that, I mean, the bills are moving forward, so people want some change. It's just what that change is going to look like.
Okay, and then so you were tracking this bill over in the House, so it's also got to get a hearing in the Senate?
Yeah, the Senate, it looks like the last step in the Senate is the Ways and Means Committee. That the House bill has made it all the way through finance, and then everything will cross over, and eventually they'll probably have to go to conference committee to work everything out. But this is a big deal. It affects all of us in Hawaii. It's more money on our electric bill in our high cost of living state, and there's kind of no way around something. It's just how much the public is going to contribute and how much Hawaiian Electric and its shareholders are going to contribute.
Okay. All right. Well, yeah, it's certainly a very important issue. We appreciate you highlighting it. But thank you so much, Stuart.
Thank you, Catherine.
That was Sybil Beat's business reporter, Stuart Yurton. You can read his story online at sybilbeat.org.
Support for HPR comes from the East-West Center Gallery's Healing Nature, Contemporary Art of Mongolia, works inspired by traditional practice and connection to nature, on view through May 4th, messaging supported by the Turban Chu Fund.
Big Island. Join Hawaii Public Radio at Kahilu Theater on Friday, March 21st for a live taping of The Conversation and Kanikapila Sunday. We talk story with author and longtime Parker Ranch veterinarian, Dr. Billy Bergen, UH biology professor Patrick Hart of Manu Minute, and Hilo singer-songwriter Kainane Kahaunaile. For more information, visit hprtickets.org, sponsored by Merriman's Restaurants and Big Island Coffee Roasters.
Support for HPR comes from Ruby Tuesday Hawaii, with locations in Moanalua and Kaneohe, offering dine-in and take-out daily and catering available for business meetings and events. RubyTuesdayHawaii.com.
Is artificial intelligence a threat to artists or not? Jason Edward Lewis is a professor of design and computation arts at Concordia University in Montreal. Brian Kamali Kawada is an associate professor at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. And the pair founded the Hawaiian and Indigenous Future Imaginaries Lab, or the Hi-Fi Lab, to direct thought and art around emerging technologies. They spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender about the new Hi-Fi Lab. Kawada starts us off.
I had like two kind of main things that really prompted the starting of the Hi-Fi Lab that both Jason and I founded. And the first is that, you know, in the Hawaiian community, there's such a beautiful blossoming of kind of linguistic recovery and cultural recovery and all of that. But I think there's so much paying attention to those things that we forget about the imagination aspect of it. You know, for example, one of the things I do in one of my classes is we do a world building exercise, kind of like how you do with fiction. You create a secondary world. And you imagine what that world could be like and use it to kind of write a story that talks about some of the issues we talk about in class. And one of my best students was having the hardest time. She just couldn't do it. And she could do everything else that we talked about in class. And then she was just like, Kumu, we're not used to imagining, forgetting that imagination is a traditional value that we've practiced for a really long time. And kind of that gets left out of our cultural kind of revival and renormalization. So that's one thing. And then the other thing is I was a small part of the Kia'i media team in 2019 when they're taking a stand against the TMT. And I think watching how all of these really, you know, unpaid grassroots folks who had several different kinds of skills. So like, you know, writing, photography, videography, graphic design, all of that. People had all of these skills within themselves. And to watch how nimble and supple they became as this team that helped to push forward, you know, Hawaiian sovereignty and aloha aina and all of these kinds of things made me really kind of want to do that for our artists as well, to like get them to, you know, we're kind of calling it like cross training, mm-hmm. you know, so like put sculptors together with dancers and photographers and, you know, see what kind of grows out of that. And so that was part of the impetus for the Hi-Fi.
And one of the first thing that you did as part of the Hi-Fi Lab was launch this artist fellowship focusing on AI. One thing that really spoke to me when I was reading, I think, the call to artists was this history of the complicated relationship that Hawaiians have with Western technology, but then also the appropriation of it for positive good. What about that drew you to this?
I always love actually looking at Hawaiian history and seeing how things played out rather than how we get told they played out in most of the history books that were written by people who are either not from Hawaii and not Hawaiian and couldn't read Hawaiian language sources and all of that. And it has a very different understanding of things. And really, there's also this fatalism around colonialism as like it's always going to win. There's no way that we avoid being kind of swallowed up by colonial powers. But really, if you look at some of the ways that Hawaiians took up Western knowledge and Western technologies and made them their own, that's really where you see the power happening. They were teasing me at the last AI thing we were at in Aotearoa because I kept talking about the 19th century Hawaiian language newspapers, right? Because that seems like the opposite of AI and what we're talking about today. But really, you know, Hawaiians took up this technology of literacy and of the newspapers specifically to really forward Hawaiian aims. You know, it was in the literary realm by publishing Hawaiian mo'olelo and putting them right next to the kind of great works of Western society, you know, like they translated Shakespeare into Olelo Hawaii and other works that are maybe not considered great literature, like 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, but, you know, they would put them right next to Hawaiian mo'olelo. Then they would also use the newspapers and this technology to further Hawaiian aims. And it became such a threat to the provisional government and the republic that they started arresting the newspaper editors, right? One of the examples I always talk about is in 1895, there was a counter-revolt, an armed counter-revolt where people took up arms to restore the kingdom, and they arrested everyone who took up arms. There was like 300 people. And right next to all of those people in their cells, they put all the newspaper editors, right? Because they were the ones who were really stirring up the population and all of that. And so to me, that's a reminder that we use these technologies, not necessarily in ways that the Western folks were envisioning for us to use them in, but we use them for our own purposes and really became powerful. And so to me, that's one of the examples of how Hawaiians use technology in this really Hawaiian way. Because even if you look at how they interacted with the newspaper, they're very Hawaiian. Like they speak to the newspapers as if they're living beings and stuff like that. And so that's what we want people to do with AI, right? Because right now we just see it as a threat. I mean, and there's some pretty threatening aspects about it, right? But I mean, you know, instead of just waiting till it's completed and here's this box of AI that everyone has to use, you know, we want to be proactive like we were with the newspapers and with these other technologies. And so that's where the imagination comes in, you know, so we can think about new ways we can use these things.
Yeah, and that's all very much like in the spirit of Abundant Intelligences, which is this larger research program that is helping fund the Hi-Fi Lab and get it off the ground, where in Abundant Intelligences, it's that argument. It's the argument that Indigenous people should be engaged in the creation of this technology. We're still in the early days. I mean, it feels like it's accelerating very quickly, but really in terms of technological development, it's still the early days. And we want to make sure that Indigenous people are in there as it is conceptualized, designed, developed, and then deployed out into the world. And by funding things like the Hi-Fi Lab, it helps us all imagine different kinds of futures for AI than what is being created for us by Silicon Valley, which is an incredibly narrow vision of what intelligence is, of what humans are, about what is possible for us, and is taking us down a particular road that instead of really thinking about how AI can contribute to abundance, like how can it contribute to us really being able to take advantage of the fact that our world is abundant. It's just that the abundance is not evenly distributed. Instead of taking us down that road, it's taken us down the road of exploitation and extraction and concentration of that power to do so much good into the hands of a few incredibly, incredibly unimaginative but powerful people.
One of the things that really is powerful to me is that art is kind of unstoppable. Like, you know, people can ignore me and Jason if we get up and give a speech about the importance of AI and Indigenous kind of epistemologies and worldviews and all of that kind of thing. Or if you, you know, you see a paper that's about that kind of thing, it's pretty easy to just kind of put it aside. But there's lots of times there's these kind of visceral reactions to art that get past a lot of our defenses. You know, like you read a story that you don't realize is talking about this kind of thing, and it starts to affect you and it starts to change how you think. And so that's one of the reasons why we figured art is so powerful for something like this. Yeah, so the first kind of major project that we're doing is an art fellowship for the future imaginaries of Indigenous AI. And the purpose of this fellowship too is kind of that cross-training and that building of what we call pilina, so relationship and connection with people, because the fellowship itself is we pick a fellow and they then get some media training, as in photography and videography and stuff like that. And then we have them attend a series of 4 workshops. Each workshop brings in an indigenous artist from either the Pacific or the continent, and then it pairs them with a Hawaii artist. So they go to the series of workshops, and then the final workshop is the fellow gives the workshop along with an artist that they've chosen.
And so what should members of the public expect from the Hi-Fi Lab?
Well, if they want to learn more, I mean, we're on social media right now. I mean, it's Hi-Fi Lab _HI. But I mean, for what the members of the public should expect, I'm hoping that what I say to you to expect is completely not what you get from Hi-Fi. And that's part of it, right? Is we want to have these wild ideas that are not just, like Jason was saying, these kind of linear iterations of something that we saw 5 years ago. We want something where it's like, what were they thinking? You know, and that is really kind of what I want to see out of it. So our first fellow we chose is Jocelyn Kapumealani-Ing, who is describes herself as a queer third generation Paniolo, but she also has a whole range of kind of media that she uses in. So she does special effects makeup, and her last show she built all of these kind of intricate headpieces out of marine debris. And she does kind of movement kinds of things. They have this really, oh, that's actually was Jara, who's coming, was a part of this project, but they have this poetry play. I don't even know how to describe it, where it's 3 of them in full costume that Jocelyn designed, and all the lines are poetry, and it's talking about all kinds of things, connection to Aina, the history of nuclear testing in the Pacific, misogyny in our cultures and in the broader culture, so many kinds of things. So Jocelyn has this really kind of vast array of things that she's doing. She's just told me she's going to start working with resin. So, like, you know, who knows what happens when you throw all of those things together. So what I would like the public to expect from us is something weird and surprising. And hopefully you're confused when you see it a little bit.
Part of the reason why we got into thinking about and talking about the future imaginary is we had been doing workshops with Indigenous youth. And one of the things that we found was there wasn't a lot of spaces in their lives where somebody sat down and said, okay, so what kind of future do you imagine for yourself? What kind of future do you want? And that even when that happened, a lot of times those future imaginaries were Western future imaginaries. They weren't Mohawk future imaginaries. They weren't Kanaka future imaginaries. And so starting to really say, okay, how do we create space for Indigenous people to ask that question of what is the future that I want? Not just to be in reaction to the futures that are being imposed on us.
Yeah, and I want to build off of what Jason's talking about, because that, you know, what is the future we want? I think it really ties back for me to a particular kind of cultural confidence. And I was talking about the newspapers earlier, and that really, to me, was a real high point of Hawaiian cultural confidence, where we were not afraid to do anything, whether it was Western-originated or Hawaiian-originated, because we knew that just by us doing it, it was going to be Hawaiian, right? We weren't worried about diluting our culture by using the newspapers or any other thing like that. Whereas now, we do worry about that, right? Is putting Olelo Hawaii in AI going to dilute our culture, or is it going to do all of these things? And so I think really kind of pushing this future imaginary and grounding it in our culture really gives people the confidence to be like, you know what, we're going to do whatever we want because it is going to be powerful and it's going to be Hawaiian because we are doing it and we're so rooted. We can't help but do it. We can't do anything else, you know? And so I think that's part of it as well, is just to be like, we can do whatever we want. And that's one of the things that I really love for my students is just kind of giving them the freedom to imagine and say, like, you know, we've done things like this for 200 years, but do we have to keep doing it like that? And yes, we want to hold on to tradition, but how can we grow these traditions? How can we be free and really let these traditions make us thrive as opposed to thinking that we have to slavishly hold on to them? So, yeah, I think those are the things that we want, is just be confident and be ourselves in these futures, right?
Brian, Jason, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
That was Brian Kamwali Kuwata and Jason Edward Lewis. They spoke with HVR's Maddie Bender about their first AI workshop, which takes place this week and is full. It's sold out. So we will have links to find out more about the Hi-Fi Lab on our website after the show.
Aloha, I'm Russell Subiono, the host of HPR's award-winning podcast, This Is Our Hawaii. We examine the legacy of large land ownership and how it impacts the community's sense of belonging. If you haven't checked it out yet, HPR is bringing it to you on the air for the first time, starting with episode 1 on Waipio Valley. And that's coming to you Sunday at 4 p.m. on HPR 1.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, one computer scientist has created a new tool to poison the AI machine.
It really is about how you see the value of technology versus the value of people.
So, what's the best way to think about the AI future?
There is an exceptional level of hype. That bubble is, in many ways, in the middle of bursting right now.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio.
Beginning this evening at 7.
Across the Pacific over the weekend, we mark the 80th anniversary of the liberation of the Philippines from the Japanese. Ceremonies took place at the Manila American Cemetery. It is where 17,000 American service members are buried, along with 570 Filipino scouts. Among them, 29 Medal of Honor recipients, 20 women, 20 sets of brothers, and a father and son. President Ferdinand R. Marcos Jr. addressed the crowd, acknowledging the long, complex history between the U.S. and the Philippines and the quest and the price for independence and democracy.
We are proud of our history and even prouder of the relationships and alliance that we have built over the many years, bound by our shared history and our common commitment to a region governed by rules, not by might, where the rights of countries, large or small, are respected. The Philippines recognizes challenges that lie ahead and is assured that we can continue to count on the help of friends, as we have done so over the last 80 years. It is truly an honor to stand with all of you today. Thank you for making the spirit of 1945 and the sacrifices of our forebears alive in our hearts today. As you later on leave these hallowed grounds, may I invite all of you to pause for a few moments of quiet remembrance for those who fought for our freedoms, for our democracy, our posterity. A few moments to remember, to honor, and to thank. May the light of their sacrifice, their nationalism, the love of country forever scatter the shadows of war, tyranny, and oppression. Thank you. Mabuhay po tayong lahat. Mabuhay ang Pilipinas.
And in a nod to the history that binds us, we're reaching into our archives to bring those stories to the forefront. Hawaii's Wilfredo Otungol knows a thing or two about duty to country. The retired lieutenant colonel in the Army Reserve served 28 years, and he is passionate about the story of Filipino veterans. We spoke to him in 2021 about the film Faces of Courage, Untold Stories of World War II Filipino Veterans. Here's Otungol talking about why the program is so important.
It's basically a story of the Filipino veterans, both from the Philippines and also from Hawaii and the continental U.S., who fought in the Philippines between 1941 and 1946, early 1946. It basically tells of how the Filipino veterans made tremendous sacrifice in helping the U.S. government fight the Japanese during the war in the Philippines. Yet, after the war, the promise that were made to the Filipino veterans that they will receive the same benefits as the regular U.S. Army soldiers were rescinded at the end of the war. and they weren't able to receive the benefits that usually the regular U.S. soldiers would get. For example, the GI Bill, you're familiar with that, and veterans' home loan, and you know, survivors' benefits. So those are, you know, benefits that they could have received if they were treated the same way as they were promised when they volunteered to help in the war effort. I mean, it's basically an injustice, you know, in my opinion, because, you know, you promised these people, these soldiers, that, look, you know, we will treat you the same as our own soldiers. And yet after the war, they pulled the rug under them through this rescission act that is still in the books. Yeah, and so they never received benefits. I'm referring to the Filipino veterans who fought in the Philippines and not the Filipino citizens, U.S. citizens or nationals who are already living in California, the West Coast, and Hawaii, who volunteered. So we also honored them, yeah? So that's the first Filipino infantry regiment. And then there was a second infantry Filipino regiment because many Filipinos in the U.S. also volunteered to help fight in the war.
Yeah, and we do hear so much about the 442nd and the highly decorated, you know, units of the Japanese Americans that fought. But the Filipinos did play a big part in the war.
Very much so, Catherine. You know, I think it would be fair to say that had the Filipinos not joined in the war effort, that U.S. probably would not be able to win the war, at least in the Philippines, and who knows, maybe even the Pacific.
Yes, and, you know, the Japanese took over, they were there in the Philippines, they were there in Guam, and, you know, I know my family was in Japanese concentration camps at the time. You know, we heard so much about the death march of Bataan in the Philippines, and how rough that was.
So the Bataan death marches, it's when they captured Bataan and the island of Corregidor, they marched over 78,000 men, almost all men, over 70 miles in a period of a little over a week without adequate provisions, food, medicine, water. And if you, you know, if you fall down and you can't get up, they just leave you alone. Or worse yet, the Japanese soldiers actually bayoneted you to death. So that's very, very famous, at least in terms of the, you know, the military circles. Over 10,000 soldiers died during that march. Yeah, Filipino, mostly Filipinos, and there's just a little over 1,000 American soldiers.
And so this film aims to tell these stories that maybe the wider audience doesn't realize happened in history, and to right the wrongs, the injustices about getting benefits for those Filipino nationals.
Yeah, primarily we wanted to educate the general public, especially the younger generation, of the contributions of these Filipino soldiers. When I was growing up and going to public school here in middle school or high school, never heard anything about the Filipino soldiers or their contribution to the war. I mean, I've heard of the 442nd and I'm familiar with their story, but there was never anything in the books about the contribution of the Philippines or the Filipino soldiers in particular during the World War II. We're hoping that at least with this film that we'd be able to educate the public, they would know about the contributions, and at the same time, hopefully that we can get them to help us down the line, maybe revoking this rescission act.
And talk about the efforts, too, by lawmakers to right this wrong.
Through the years, there's been some effort to rectify the injustice. Two individuals in particular deserves credit, and that's the two Dannys, the two senators, Daniel Inouye and Daniel Akaka. They have tried to reinstate the benefits that should have been given to these veterans. You know, this is as early as in the 1990s, or even earlier, I believe, but they were unsuccessful. And I think it's because of money, how much it's going to cost. We're talking about, you know, hundreds of thousands of people who are still alive at that time. So, you know, they were unsuccessful. But eventually, they were able to at least provide some partial remedy through compensation. They awarded 15,000 lump sum one-time payment to Filipino veterans who are living in the U.S. and $9,000 to veterans who are living in the Philippines, okay, as long as they can prove that they fought the war. Secondly, there were a partial granting of immigration to the U.S. for Filipino veterans who wants to come over. In the late 80s, the bill was passed and was signed into law, I believe in 1990, that would allow Filipino veterans to immigrate to the U.S. So thousands immigrated. I don't know the exact number, but we're talking about maybe 25,000. A lot of them moved to Hawaii because they heard about Hawaii and how it's almost like the Philippines in terms of the climate and the large Filipino population. So I think the estimate was like we had almost between 2,500 to 3,000 Filipinos who came to Hawaii. But they have to come by themselves. They cannot bring their family. So some of them have spouses. They can't bring their spouse right away. They have to go through the process of becoming citizens and then petitioning for their spouses. And if they have minor children, they can. But any other relatives, they're treated differently. I'm sure you're familiar with the quota system for each country. So some of their adult children who they petition are still waiting.
And there was also, though, idea that there were stories of valor. There were soldiers that should be eligible for the Congressional Medal.
Right. And I believe it was around 2016, the public law that was passed awarded the Congressional Gold Medal, which is the highest award that the country can bestow, by Congress, and then signed into act by President Obama, which basically awarded Congressional Gold Medals to any service member, not just Filipinos, but primarily Filipinos. That's why it's called the Filipino Veterans Congressional Gold Medal Act, who fought between, I believe it's like 1941 all the way to almost the end of 1946. So if you fought in some kind of capacity, you're entitled to receive this Congressional Gold Medal. So the Filipino Veterans Recognition and Education Project established this medal through the Act of Congress. And this is a self-supporting endeavor. So it's not funded by Congress. The PhilVetRef, for short, basically raised the funds to buy the medal, to award it. We have a ceremony, and then we give it to the living veterans if they're still alive, or if they've passed, we still honor them through their next of kin. So the next of kin receives it.
So how many have they awarded so far?
In Hawaii, we've awarded over 200 medals, and we're still awarding them. We had two public ceremonies. The first one, we awarded over 150. And then the second one, I think we awarded over 75.
So with this film, though, you're hoping to raise awareness and then raise funds for this cause?
Yeah, of course, it's totally voluntary. And, we are a tax-deductible nonprofit. And because we do incur expenses in terms of not just the medal, because now the medal costs over $150 each, but also we have an education project. We're trying to push out this curriculum that hopefully school will adopt nationwide. So if they want more information, they can go to Duty to Country, just one word, no space, dutytocountry.org.
We've been hearing from Wilfredo Tungol with the Filipino Veterans Recognition Education Project, PhilVetRep for short. We will have a link to Move Me Hawaii, where you can register to stream the film on our website later today. In a nod to the 80th anniversary of the liberation of Manila from the Japanese, we are highlighting a veteran from the 1st Filipino Infantry Regiment, which was formed by Filipino Americans. They chose the motto, Laging Una, which means always first in Tagalog. HPR's Wayne Yoshioka reported on an Army veteran who wanted to help the families of those he served with.
Domingo Los Baños was born in Wahiawa and moved to Kauai when he was in the fourth grade. In 1944, he joined the Army.
1st Philippine Infantry Regiment, U.S. Army. I was 18 at the time.
He served as the unit first sergeant and deployed to the Philippines 2 years after General Douglas MacArthur escaped from the island of Corregidor.
300 of the local boys, we joined the task force that went to the Philippines. We were the ones that were watching the activities of the enemy, part of MacArthur's eyes and ears, and help him keep his promise to the people of America and the Philippines of I shall return.
Los Baños received the Congressional Gold Medal, the highest U.S. civilian award, for his service in the Philippines. He's now one of 5 members still alive from the 1st Filipino Infantry Regiment and would like to help family members receive the award.
We're having difficulty getting in touch with the next of kin, but we found out that wherever these people are buried on military cemeteries, they can get their 214 forms from those mortuaries, which is vital to the information that's needed in a blank form that they need to fill up. Once you fill that blank, put it in the proper authorities, they can get the gold medal.
The 214 is a Department of Defense form that documents a person's military service. Los Baños also participates in ceremonies that honor 17 Filipino scouts who died aboard the USS Seawolf in 1944. A bell at submarine base Pearl Harbor rings 52 times on Memorial Day and Veterans Day for the submarines lost in World War II. 3,500 crew members also lost their lives.
USS Seawolf, SS-197, sunk 3 October 1944 by friendly forces on her 15th war patrol, 100 men lost.
Los Baños represents the veterans of foreign wars, Waipahu Post 1572, at these ceremonies. He says he will turn 93 in September, but is making a promise to get the word out to 1st Filipino Infantry Regiment families. He's committed to keeping that promise, just as he did for the one he made in the Philippine jungle 74 years ago.
Before I went into that battle, I prayed, God, get me out of harm's way and I'll be a teacher. So pulled me out, I was safe. So I went to school at Springfield College, Massachusetts. And then I started my teaching career. Then I got to be a principal, and I got to be a district superintendent of Leeward for 11 years.
That was Domingo Los Baños, a well-known Hawaii educator, World War II veteran, and advocate for fellow Filipinos who fought in the war. He spoke with former HBR reporter Wayne Yoshioka back in 2018. Los Baños died a year later at age 93. That wraps it up for us today. Tomorrow, we plan to talk about geothermal energy. What can Hawaii learn from our neighbors in New Zealand? We do welcome feedback. Call our TalkBack line, 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can also find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.